the 1890s to 1914, both foreign policy and domestic politics, but I'll have to say this, it's heavily weighted in the direction of foreign policy more than domestic politics. About the only domestic politics we'll really look at is the Progressive Reform Era and the 1912 election, and everything else will be really focused on foreign policy. So before we begin this, I'm going to ask just some general questions about foreign policy. This may not be what you, with your friends, sit around and have a beer and talk about, but it's the ones that I always like to get into. And that is there a consistent American foreign policy that has existed from its inception, from 1789 to 2007? Or has it changed? Or are there both? Are there patterns that remain the same and that there are some vector changes that have occurred? If so, let's kind of talk about that, and then we'll focus back into exactly the 1890s and see where that fit into our discussion. I think so. Well, there's a case to be made that we've been consistently isolationist as well as international and interventionist. So if that's the case, let's kind of, in the beginning of the nation, I guess, becoming free from Britain, we had to have a foreign policy with somebody else besides Britain. Who was that? France. France helped us get free. And what did we, for those who remember this, what did we offer to France for the help of getting us free? Well, there was some land exchanges to come later with Louisiana, but not in 1789. That would come in 1803. The alliance itself, trade, that's the key element I want to get. We made a military alliance with France, but the obvious truth is, yeah, we didn't have the military power to help France in Europe. They had the military power to help us here. So what we offered was trade. More precisely, we offered trade with no barriers, no tariffs. And that is something that's real important there, is that from 1789 to this time period, 1890s, from 1789, so a good century, to the 1890s, the United States really didn't have the military force to wage war overseas, but it could manipulate its wishes or work one country against another by offering free trade with no tariffs or no barriers. So the trade is what we had to offer. Then as the 20th century comes into being, we begin into this race I'll talk about of wanting to be on equal with Europe as far as power is concerned. Then we have both. Offer the trade and pull it back, offer the military alliance or offer to threaten, etc. But there is also a cultural foreign policy that America practiced from its beginning till 2007, I'm going to boldly claim. Changed a little after Pearl Harbor, but I think there's a cultural foreign policy that felt this way. Why did people come to America? And we're not talking African Americans who were forced. For a better life, yes. And what made it better here? Opportunity and freedom. So there was the chance to make a buck, and there was a chance to be treated fairly and equally, both of which was missing from Europe or from other countries. And so therefore, what was our attitude about the home countries where our ancestors came from? That's right. That's the way to say it. They're defiled. They're decrepit. They're sinners. I mean, that was really the attitude. That the old world was filled with corrupt ways. So do you let your children play with those kind of kids? Not at all. And so therefore, as another piece of American foreign policy, is the feeling and fear that too much association with corrupt people will corrupt our nation. A nation based on democracy and republicanism and constitutional freedoms. Ignore the slavery part, that part, which Europe always wagged its finger at and said, you know, hey, how about this? But that was, so some of our foreign policy was built on the idea, we like to make money off of you people, but we hope we don't hang around long enough to pick up your bad habits. So there is that kind of an isolationist attitude feeling. And as far as the defense situation, it is true we gain a military to defend ourselves by the start of the 20th century, but even up to that point, we didn't really feel threatened. And let's think for a second. After independence and the Revolutionary War, what military conflicts with Europe did we have until the 20th century? Very few. There was a little short war with France in 1798. War of 1812, but we caused that ourselves by going over there and getting involved in it. We didn't have to get into that. After the War of 1812, what wars with Europe did we get into? Nothing until the Spanish-American War in 1898. So we didn't even need a military, did we? Why not? Why were we safe?
We were isolated.
Yes, by water. Yes, I was looking for the map that would show the whole thing there, but this is better for our study of China. So the two oceans, the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean, was the best defense one needed. And that's why we were able to grow wealthy and safe apart from the rest of the world. And that became kind of like too much of something we depended upon, and so therefore we were quite shocked out of it by what event? What event in... Yeah, Pearl Harbor is supposedly the ending of the ocean defense. However, wait a second, let's look at this. We claim we were attacked in Pearl Harbor. This is not the best map for us. There is this feeling that homeland soil has finally been breached by the Pearl Harbor attack. Homeland soil wasn't touched. A colonially occupied state was touched. A place we took over whether they liked it or not. We made them into a territory. That's what was attacked. So our outpost, our empire was attacked. People don't like to hear that. Our territory. That's much different than someone coming right to New York City and blowing down a building for 3,000 people. That's why if people are not sure about why 9/11 has significance, that is really the first time since 1815, when the bridge burned Washington, that any kind of serious attack on home soil of contiguous states occurred. So foreign policy attitudes change after World War II because of that. But this is actually something that, so people, there are people who say, you know, there's been no attack since then. Why are some of these liberal Democrats making a big to-do about, you know, the war on terror? It's a fake war on terror. Well, it has a start that is more significant than any other. What follows is, you know, what history will do. So, again, what we're kind of doing in foreign policy is we just didn't have a lot of threat or need to worry about Europe. Most of our foreign policy from, say, 1789 up to 1867 dealt with this, the expansion of U.S. soil. So I thought maybe it might be some use. I know this is a lot of repeat for those who've heard it, but I think it helps the future make sense. Let's look at what brought each piece of acquisition into possession. When the U.S. negotiated a treaty with Britain in 1783, ending the Revolutionary War, what became the first of the United States? From where to where? Yeah, the 13 colonies on towards? Yes, and all the way out to the Mississippi River. So everything east of the Mississippi minus Florida, as you pointed out, minus Florida, became the new United States. Then this became part of the United States in what year? You please, man. 1803, the Louisiana Purchase from whom?
France.
From France, and that may not seem significant now, but there was a lot of foreign policy maneuvering going on in terms of France trying to conquer Europe, giving up, and finally selling up Louisiana. So it was something that was gnarly in the European affairs, but for us, it was just a case of doubling the size of our country and eliminating any French threat of then building an empire here. Then Texas and the Mexican Cession and California, all of that came in from Mexico, and especially this area came in ways that are real dubious in regards to whether we justify such things today. The Oregon Territory was mutually claimed by four powers, eventually just Britain and ourselves, and then Britain took the northern section and we declared this. So the acquisition of all the lands of the contiguous states was foreign policy. And outside of the acquiring of that lands, American foreign policy really focused upon protecting our trade with Europe, protecting a growing trade by the end of the 19th century with China and the Far East, and with Latin America. So trade and don't pollute us with your cultural ways was the face of American foreign policy from the beginning to the 1890s. That said, we see a watershed change in thinking occur in the 1890s with number one on our sheet here. We just did what's in the parentheses, where it says deviation from traditions and policies. We did all those traditions and policies. And rightly, you figured out we're finally doing something that could be on a quiz and a test. It's a time in the 1890s when the U.S. began to flirt with, embark upon, and become romanticized with expansionism or empire building. And to draw just a little bit from item C, and I'll come back to it in a moment, a lot of it has to do with feeling competitive with Europe. Europe is in a new race for colonies. The latter half of the 19th century, we see an upsurge of new European colonialism in Africa, in the Middle East, Far East. And so in many ways, the U.S. feels like, now that we are, or at least now that we want to be perceived as a major world power, we're not going to let the Europeans get the choice places. But this didn't sit well with a deeper psyche. Because even those people who were really avid expansionist imperialists, what do you think probably should have been, or was really, a gnawing guilt inside? I hope, at least. One that Europeans just didn't worry about. Well, when's the official start of our nation? 1776, July 4th. And in the document, the Declaration of Independence, what is the explanation for why we are declaring independence?
Parliament.
That Parliament has done us wrong and therefore we must protect our rights. And those rights are life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and the right to have government by the consent of the governed. People have the right to choose who rules them. And when those people lose their consent, they have the right to change. So when you go conquering foreign countries, whether they want to be conquered or not, that kind of harlotry should have a little bit of guilt from where you're supposed to have been back home, right? We were supposed to be believing in justice, believing in people have the right to rule themselves. Wouldn't there be a certain degree of a split heart and mind about the idea of no matter what you manufacture in A through D to defend it, there should have been some haunting feeling that Americans don't do this stuff. That's what we always complain about others doing. But we did for a while. From the 1890s into the early first decade of the 20th century, there is this kind of ambitious race to collect colonies and grow. It doesn't last. Now, if you're a real bitter leftist, you can argue it lasts completely in Latin America through the 20s and 30s, etc. And there's a case to be made there, but I think a middle ground view suggests that the short-lived experience of expansionism from 1890 to 1904 ended because of it just wasn't comfortable on the Americans' hearts. But here's the reasons we got it started. Item A. It has much to do with the closing of the frontier, both in a psychological as well as in a business sense. Some of you may have read about, this you don't have to write down at all, you may have read about an historian called Frederick Jackson Turner. I used to talk about him. He was one of the items cut out of the last sheet. Just kind of listen to this for a second. Don't have to write about it. Turner was, well, how can I back up and say this? There were no American professional historians for the 1880s and 1890s. There were historians, but they were people who made their living being lawyers or writers or school teachers or something. But as a professional publishing historian, college instructor type, that was pretty rare. That had not become a discipline in and of itself. In the 1880s and 1890s, it comes to be for the first time a professional discipline in higher education because it had so in Europe. So the trend is spreading here from Europe. And Turner is one of those first early professional historians. Most of the early first professional historians proposed that you can learn most of all what you need about American culture by studying Germanic English culture. It's this idea that we have this Germanic, Teutonic, Anglo-Saxon cultural roots, so you study that, you've got Americans down. Turner was very opposed to that idea. His attitude was that that may have been what the first people who came from Europe by choice brought, but their whole thinking and attitude was drastically changed by the experience of living in the frontier. That when one has to make a life for themselves in the frontier, old-fashioned attitudes and values dissipate quickly. It doesn't matter what your name was, who you were born with, what wealth you had. Proving yourself as someone who's a rugged individual, proving yourself as someone who cares about society from the equal way, those were the values that arose from the frontier experience. And he put that together in a work called The Significance of the Frontier, published in 1893. So you may run across that in the textbook. Why I'm even touching on Turner is because Turner, in his thesis, made this observation. He said he looked at the census report. And the census report comes out how often? Every 10 years. So 1790 would be the first one, and 1800, 1810, etc. And what he noticed was that if you look at the census report and where demographically, where people lived, there was a steady line of high concentration in the east that became more and more sparse as you moved west. Eventually California picks up and moves eastward. But that all the way up to the 1880 census report, there's still big lines of unsettled area, at least unsettled by Anglo-Saxon people, in the western Rocky Mountain plains areas. But in the 1890 census report, there are so many little scattered pockets of population around that there is no longer a frontier. And so what Turner is proposing in his book is that even if a physical frontier has vanished, Americans have lived for well over a century and a half with the belief in a psychological frontier, that there's always a place to go west and make a fresh start for yourself. And what he concluded was that even when there's no longer physically a place to go, we'll always believe there will be one. And it became fun for historians throughout the 20th century to say, does Turner still apply? Well, as late as 2007, do we still feel like we can just uproot and go somewhere and make a fresh start? We do. And in fact, if you don't, if you have three or four generations of people living in the same house as great-grandparents, you might be assessed how. I mean, I would be glad to do that if I could, but you might be assessed how. Someone who couldn't make it on their own. You didn't move somewhere and prove yourself. That's a real social contrast between American property society values and Europe. So all of this was to say that there was a belief in about 1890 that the frontier was disappearing, was closing, whether it was psychological or whether it was physical. It definitely was commercially. This is why this is on item A, is that business investors, industrialists, who used to be able to find cheap resources from Western sources and good markets, found this area starting to fill up and competition was making it no longer profitable. It was too expensive to buy those resources compared to what it used to be. Markets were saturated. So business persons in America began to look and see what European business persons were doing, and that is they were looking overseas for new markets and new sources of raw materials. And it helps a whole lot to get over there if you have a military to escort you. And so what happened was for Europeans, there is a pattern where first the military comes in and then French, English, or Italian business follows. And the military defends the business interests. The business interests find the way to make more weapons for the military, and there is this collusion that takes place. In fact, Eisenhower talked about it as late as 1961 in his farewell address when he warned America about what he thought was the growing military-industrial complex. There probably is now greater than ever a military-industrial complex that connives together to do these things, but the Europeans always did it better. They could conquer an area, make profits, keep people down through weapons, because they just didn't have that guilt of the Declaration of Independence to haunt them like we do. So this is kind of what's going on in A, is that business persons in America, investors, look to the overseas markets for more profits. That's one of the contributing factors to expansionism in the 1890s. Again, following the European lead, the second example comes to mind. And that is this feeling that, is it fair for us to be the only persons on the planet that are democratic Protestant Christians that know freedom? God didn't mean for it just to stay here. And I'm not being sarcastic. People really felt this way sincerely. I think so too. And so therefore, when you move over and take over parts of China or parts of the Philippines or whatever part you're happening to, if you spread American commercial, free market, capitalist, Protestant society, that's a pretty good deal. And if people are not really comfortable with it at first, they'll come to appreciate it after they get used to it. I can't remember if it's Full Metal Jacket or Platoon, but one of those two films, which I'll never watch again, because it's so hard to watch, but there's a scene where one of the soldiers, who's also a journalist, has something like a peace sign written on his helmet. And when he walks up to the commander chews him out for his attitude, what's on the helmet. And he makes a comment, which is a racist comment, but it fits the theme we're working on here. He says, "Don't you realize that inside of every one of these gooks is an American trying to get out?" Is that Full Metal Jacket? Now, I don't know if that's truly what people were still feeling as late as the Vietnam War, but it sure is what was being felt in the 1890s. that people who are racially inferior and culturally inferior can be uplifted by American civilization. Racist? Sure, it's racist. Which kind of sometimes opens up the question of, is there a difference between benign, is there a benign racism? I mean, it's one thing to go kill everybody and steal all their land, and then there's another to say, let's make them all good commercial farmers and Christians. It's both racist, but is one a little more benign than the other? It's not an easy question to even ponder. Put it in the direct...
You're blaming things on God.
That's true.
Well, God told me to do it.
Well, are we to give any... What's the word for it? Excuse or forgiveness to the one who thinks they're doing God's will by doing that, historically. I mean, that's not our place to make judgments, I guess. Oh, very, very comparable, but I would hate to get into that. I want to stay hired. But yeah, I think you've hit too relevant of a point there. To keep it vague, if I could, think about it in terms of, like, say, a husband who says all women should be just kept barefoot and pregnant. Versus, she is on a pedestal, the idol, she is the queen, she is the angel. I don't want her being defiled by the work world and the political world. It's too ugly and staining for her. We'll keep her safe. He may believe that and worship her. Is he still a sexist?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, can there be a benign... can there be a benign sexist?
No.
No, I don't think so either. But I think that's what Americans felt in item B, is that, and Europeans too, that it is our responsibility and mission to spread faith, religion, and culture to these peoples. Therefore, it's not an evil conquering, it's a liberating. Well, again, let the chips fall where they may on this kind of thing. This is the same kind of thinking that was used to take these lands. When people acquired Louisiana Territory, especially the Mexican area, the attitude was, we're going to bring a better culture and a better system to these people, they'll be better off for it. One of the aspects that they instituted to try to be serious about this was that when all the yellow area was taken from Mexico, really against their will, to a war, every Mexican living in that area was made automatic citizens of the U.S. at that time. Property-owning citizens. I don't really believe that. Well, I guess I shouldn't say that, because I guess it really, the thinking that it would be a slam dunk, easy walk in and we'd be treated as liberators does carry that feeling. I think there was always kind of the understanding that being a different culture, they were not going to be comfortable to accept, definitely not accepting Christianity. And as far as democracies, thought it would have to be a long training session. I don't know how to say on that. The neocons who formulated that invasion, to what, and we're back to the classic foreign policy question. How much of it was to protect profits and trade? How much of it was to promote human rights, which we haven't gotten into discussing? We will, though. How much of it was based on the idea of creating a better world, strategic position, so we are safe from further attack? Those questions about the war in Iraq can go all the way back to the Spanish-American War, really. Yeah, that's, I try to forgive Bush on that in this sense. One time I was talking to a student at the African-American student at the University of Arkansas, and got the strangest look, nothing said, got the strangest look, and after I was done, I said, what did I say? And I was thinking back about what I'd said, and I'd used the expression to call a spade a spade. Learned a lesson in a hurry that day. I didn't know I'd fouled up. Until I thought about what I must have said. Do you think using the expression crusade was innocent mistake on his part or a lack of cultural awareness? Could be so. Mine wasn't, I hope. But to say about his, yeah. Well, we've all done that. How often do we repeat it? Maybe the measure. There's more in B here. One of the persons who becomes an important figure in this is Congregational Puritan minister Josiah Strong from Boston, Massachusetts. who was so in favor of spreading U.S. culture and justifying it through military action that he wrote a book called Our Country. And in Our Country, he spells out that it is the duty and mission of Christians to conquer foreign lands because of all the virtue that will be spread. And that people who do not want to engage in expansionism, selfish people who want to be isolated, will incur God's wrath. So he was very sincere about this again. This is not a tongue-in-cheek writing. That Strong's book, Our Country, proposed and defended the idea of expansionism on the grounds that if we don't spread Christianity and American cultural values, we leave these people stranded, and that's God's wish that we spread it, and we're denying our responsibility. So again, what we've just been discussing comes into effect. Was this person full serious, and could they not see the hypocrisy of their ways? Maybe not. You know, one of the things I meant to mention about Jane Addams, maybe I did, I think I forgot to mention, was Jane Addams was a big one on saying to immigrants in Chicago, you're never going to make it till you drop the accent and change the spelling of the name and dress more Anglo. And she just really pushed the young kids especially to do that. Is that a disrespecting of culture? By 2007 standards? By 1889 standards? Yeah, it depends on what success meant. And economic success meant a lot in that time. Item C. This is what I kind of already touched on and alluded to. There was a competitive feeling with Europe. The Europeans are involved in taking over parts of Africa and the Far East. They're going to get the best markets. They're going to be the ones to spread maybe not American Christianity, but that warped old bad European version. So we've got to get on the ball and hurry about this thing and get over there and start spreading Americanism before they take over and before they get all the markets. And this kind of competitive feeling led, obviously, not just with us, but between Europeans themselves, into a very aggressive, ambitious foreign policy, which led to war on occasions. And the description of this kind of foreign policy thinking is called jingoism. Probably heard that expression before. It comes from an old British naval song, which had a line in it that says, we don't want to fight by jingo, but if we have to, we have the money and the time to. So the expression jingoism means when you have such an aggressive foreign policy that your nation's honor, your nation's interests are threatened, and you must go to war with someone else to defend and spread those interests. So jingoism, the Europeans illustrated, was a catching fever that Americans picked up also. The term jingoism means to have an aggressive, confrontational foreign policy based on the belief that your interest, your pride, your honor, your nation's well-being is threatened by someone else. You could say this, that after the 9/11 attack, the desire to go to war with some Arab country was definitely a reflection of an upsurge of jingoism in America. And I would make a case for this, for those who follow it back. The jingoistic feeling against Arab nations goes all the way back to the oil embargo of 73 and the hostage crisis in Iran in 79. That really feeds into that feeling, even though they're not Arabs even. You know, but Islamic anti-feeling, there is that feeling that American pride and virtue and culture has been challenged and threatened, and aggressive foreign policy is the way to meet this. Item D. It was also the desire to expand or to build an empire in the 1890s is this fresh new social Darwinist thinking. We talked about social Darwinism as being a factor for upsurge of racism in America. It is what the Europeans are preaching, and especially and specifically Northwestern Europeans. The Nordic, Teutonic, Anglo-Saxon Europeans are arguing that they are a superior breed. They therefore have the right to conquer foreign lands. Of course, they didn't have a Declaration of Independence to haunt them as badly as we did. But we have bought into this also. Most of the institutions in anthropological studies and the Ivy League colleges are pushing this notion that there are superior white people. We had that on one of the test questions. And therefore, that justifies us taking over them. I think to some degree there's still a feeling there. But not as bad, though. Not as badly. Maybe not ethnically, but maybe still culturally and commercially, that feeling. Well, these are factors. These are contributing reasons to why expansionism arose. Let me give two more other things before. We won't get to four yet. We'll stop early. But I want to talk about two and three because it'll help round this out. In two, we see some famous prominent politicians who were expansionists: Theodore Roosevelt, Henry Cabot Lodge, and Albert J. Beveridge. He's not as well known as the first two. You might remember Roosevelt more from being a reform politician, a progressive reformer. He was a bit of a dichotomy. He was for honest, clean. He was a goo-goo, literally. He was a mugwump. He was for honest, cleaned-up politics at home. But when it came to overseas, he was all of A through D. Very, very strong expansionist, willing to dictate for other people how they should live, and all the time kind of not even seeing it in his own self. When he was president, he would argue America should walk softly and carry a big stick, this idea that it's not us causing the trouble. But it was. It was literally, under Roosevelt policy, he was pushing American might and power in places where they didn't want us. But it was all from this justification attitude. So as a social Darwinist, as an expansionist, Roosevelt felt that firmly. And some people see that. How could he be so seemingly liberal in domestic policies and so hawkish in foreign policy? But for him, there was no contradiction. That, yeah, he was a social Darwinist, but at the same time, very concerned about social justice. Jack London, the writer, was like that. A communist and a social Darwinist at the same time in his writings. It's really hard to see how one could reconcile that. But it's the thinking of the age. Henry Cabot Lodge was a Massachusetts senator, and he was probably the most prominent foreign relations senator because he was the head of the Foreign Relations Committee quite often. And so treaty making and conduct and business dealings with foreign countries always had to go through him or it didn't happen. He's better remembered not as an expansionist this time, but he's better remembered rather as being one who fought against Woodrow Wilson in the Versailles Treaty in 1919. He was probably the major reason we never joined the League of Nations, is because he was such a personal enemy of Wilson. And that'll be covered more in a future testing period. His son, was it grandson? I think it's son. Henry Cabot Lodge's son was a senator also from Massachusetts who in 1952 lost to whom? Lost his re-election bid to what new House member seeking the Senate? John F. Kennedy. Kind of suddenly that look in your eyes reminds me of a scene from Back to the Future. JFK Express. Who the hell's that? 1955 and the next president's not even yet. Could that be true for us? Somebody's going to be the next president we never heard of? Could be. That wasn't the end of Lodge. He, during the Eisenhower years, worked as the ambassador to the United Nations. And then after that, he ran as a running mate for Richard Nixon in 1960. So, name dropping in history always looks so intellectual rather than arrogant. So. Anyway, so but it's his father, Henry Cabot Lodge Sr., who is one of these 1880s, 1890s pro-expansionists. And that the reason that's of significance is because he can help get funding going for the building of a larger navy, which will take place down in item 3. And then lesser known, but remembered primarily for his quotes, is Indiana Senator Albert J. Beveridge. And he's made a number of quotes like this, but this is one that was in an old textbook that I always remembered I wanted to share with you. Listen to what he's saying here, if I can say it loud enough to get over the door here. Listen to what he's... Do you want me to close that, or you want to leave? How about we close it? Let me say it, and then we'll leave. Pardon?
I'll be right. Indiana Senator. I'm not mentally able. We'll just finish with the quote.
It'll be faster if I just read the quote. Beveridge in 1898 would make the following statement: American factories are making more than the American people can use. American soil is producing more than they can consume. Fate has written our policy for us. The trade of the world must and shall be ours. We will establish trading posts throughout the world as distributing posts for American products. We'll cover the ocean with our merchant marine. We'll build a navy to the measure of our greatness. Great colonies governing themselves, flying our flag, trading with us, will grow about our posts of trade. And American law, American order, and American civilization and the American flag will plant themselves on shores hitherto bloody and benighted. Anything in there catch your attention? I mean, what's he covering in that quote? Well, it's kind of got it all. Markets, religion, civilization. But here's the part that I think is going to be, and of course, all the emphasis upon trade. There's always that emphasis upon protecting foreign profits and trade. They're going to benefit from the trade, too. But listen to this line. Great colonies governing themselves flying our flag. Is that a contradiction, or is that feasible? That's exactly federalism. That's the United States. The fact that the 50 states all govern themselves to a certain degree, but are united under the American flag. So there was this thinking that it just didn't have to be Alaska and Hawaii, that you could have sovereign states that are glad to be part of the Union but still under American control growing. He wasn't the only one to think like that at this turn of the century time. Yeah, let's see. That's a good place to stop. We'll pick up with Alfred Thayer Mahan when we return and go on from there.
Is this a publication for the National Review?
Yeah, it's a conservative.